Hello and welcome to The Corridor here on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario, and podcasting on Spotify and Apple Music. I'm Dinah Jansen, and with me is CFRC Local Journalism Initiative news producer Jesse Bell. This regional news program features news from Kingston and area provided by local and regional journalists through the support of the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Welcome and enjoy. Hello and welcome to The Corridor. I'm Dinah Jansen, and today I'm joined by CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative producer Jesse Bell. Our first story is from CFRC's Local Journalism Initiative reporter Christina Laurie, covering Kingston's municipal music strategy.
At their May 20th meeting, Council reaffirmed their support for the Kingston Music Strategy and unanimously approved an additional $200,000 for Tourism Kingston's Music Office to continue implementing the strategy. The city hit play on the Municipal Music Strategy in 2024 to bolster a vibrant and sustainable local music scene. With the long list of goals and priorities, including accessible rehearsal space, performance opportunities, mentorship opportunities, and providing a variety of venues to perform in, Tourism Kingston, chiefly its music office, has been leading the charge. Council was presented with a one-year update along with the motion to put additional funding into the initiative. Highlights of the first-year update include the creation of the City Music Officer position, a Kingston Music Advisory Committee to guide the strategy's implementation, 32 workshops held with 1,157 attendees, and 14 events sponsored in 2024, generating an economic impact of $272,439, with 324 artists and bands impacted and 10,747 attendees. As for what comes next, ensuring fair wages for musicians seems to be one of the top priorities. Michael Broadhead, a local musician, spoke before council with a focus on the economic challenges faced by musicians.
I want our scene to be sustainable, and I'm concerned that things like the housing crisis are reaching a point where we cannot sustain things like this anymore. And what I'm seeing is mass burnout of promoters and people in the DIY scene and people leaving Kingston despite the music strategy. Musicians need two things first and foremost, and the degree to which those two things are present in any effort to help musicians to me reflects the degree to which musicians' interests are represented in comparison to other interests around musicians. And those two things are professional standards for pay in any registered business and free or very accessible DIY or space for the DIY scene. If other people are sacrificing their love of the game, the landlord needs to as well. If people are expecting to invest and then make profit off those investments, everybody should be able to make a living. Those are the two standards. And what I see in policy is the more things that aren't those two reflects the more other people would like a policy to not be focusing on those two issues because they don't support their interest. And so my concerns are really that other interests around music can get in and make money off of musicians while the vast majority of musicians don't see the benefit of that economic development. Musicians' pay can go to zero, and that has effects on social structures and norms. This also inversely means that a price of zero would imply an infinite supply of musical labor, which is not true, but some people treat us like it's the case.
When the floor opened for councillors to discuss the report, Councillor Wendy Steven also expressed a need for more community feedback and fair wage discussion moving forward.
When I read this report, it outlined a lot of really great work, and I couldn't quite figure out, it felt like something was missing. And then it dawned on me that what I was really hoping to see that wasn't in the report this time that I would really like staff to include next time is that industry feedback and community voice. So I think our delegation made a really interesting point that the music scene wouldn't exist without musicians. So I feel like we really need to capture their voice along with, as we heard, there's a whole industry around them, right? So all these other different peripheral jobs that are connected to the music. So just a comment to staff, you know, thank you. And I'd really, really like to see that included next time. The second piece I wanted to comment on was that in the report, it outlined how fair pay will be explored more in 2025. So again, as indicated by our delegation, fair pay is a really critical piece. And Council Ridge, that's interesting. I didn't realize you were a part of that union. So one of the comments I wanted to make as well is that I'm very curious about the outcomes when it comes to fair pay when working with, I wrote down the name so I could get it right, the Union of Professional Musicians, Local 518. So I really look forward to seeing where that goes.
The city's director of arts and culture services, Danica Lockhead, confirmed that setting standards in this department will be a priority heading into the next year of the strategy.
I think just to the fair wage discussion, you know, the music strategy does include a strategic action to develop a fair wage policy for the city of Kingston, but that will really look at, that will come back to council and will really look at mandating a fair wage for musicians for all city of Kingston sponsored events. You know, City of Kingston partner events, but I think more broadly to sort of also act as a tool to advocate sector-wide, community-wide, for the value of paying musicians a fair wage. The city doesn't have necessarily the mandate to, you know, to mandate fair wage elsewhere, but we do have the capacity to lead by example and bring into policy this fair wage and hopefully encourage others to do the same.
Council unanimously approved the additional funding, paving the way for more progress from the Music Office in 2025, all part of shaping the soundtrack to life in Kingston. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you, Chris. Next is Dinah Jansen with a story from the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for the Brockville Recorder and Times, Keith Dempsey, about a code of conduct breach from Gananoque Mayor Jim Beddoes.
Thank you, Jesse. Gananoque Council has decided to suspend Mayor John Beddoes' pay following an Integrity Commissioner's report that found multiple breaches of the Municipal Code of Conduct, including harassment, discriminatory remarks, and aggressive behavior. The investigation conducted by Tony Fleming's office was launched following 18 formal complaints, 8 of which were substantiated, according to the commissioner. The most serious findings centered on the mayor's treatment of staff and fellow members of council. Among those findings, Mayor Beddoes was found to have made multiple comments suggesting that the town's chief administrative officer could be fired, with statements such as "the CAO should be fired" made on separate occasions. The report concluded these repeated remarks created an atmosphere of intimidation and amounted to a pattern of harassment, leaving staff concerned about job security. In addition, the mayor was found to have made discriminatory remarks related to women and affirmative action, contributing to what the report described as a workplace environment that devalued the contributions of female staff. Beddoes also acknowledged telling an offensive sexual joke, according to the report. While the behavior was not repeated, the Integrity Commissioner emphasized that such conduct from someone in a position of authority is unacceptable and likely discouraged any staff objections due to the inherent imbalance of power. The report also detailed an incident during an agenda-setting meeting in which Beddoes was found to have behaved aggressively toward another councillor. Although the mayor disputed raising his voice, multiple witnesses recalled the behavior as intimidating and inappropriate. For these 4 categories of breach found by the Integrity Commissioner, the latter recommended a cumulative 80-day suspension of the mayor's remuneration, 30 days for harassment of the CAO, 30 days for discriminatory comments, 5 days for the offensive sexual joke, and 15 days for aggressive behavior toward a fellow council member. Council opted to suspend Beddoes' pay and required the mayor to issue a formal apology to town staff. Beddoes has acknowledged the findings of the report and expressed a commitment to improving communication and collaboration with both staff and council moving forward. Thank you to Keith Dempsey for that story. Now over to Jesse Bell with a story from the LJI reporter for the Kingstonist, Michelle Dory Forstell, about the rollout of the Alertable app in Kingston.
Thank you, Dinah. Thanks to a new web-based app, public safety and security announcements from the Kingston Police Force are now available instantaneously. At the Thursday, May 15th meeting of the Kingston Police Services Board, Constable Anthony Colangeli, Kingston Police Media Relations / Urban Foot Patrol Officer, spoke to the board regarding the recent launch of the Alertable app locally. Colangeli told KPSB that the Kingston Police are now using Alertable to send emergency alerts and daily community notices for facilities, roads, parks, schools, various municipal services, pandemics, fires, floods, severe weather, and other hazards. Alertable is a product developed by PEASI, which Colangeli described as a Calgary-based Canadian mass notification software company. It is used to publish emergencies and day-to-day public notices, like closures, restrictions, and hazards in advance. Colangeli noted the service can be used for all types of emergencies, including missing persons and road closures. Importantly, police can choose a geolocation with Alertable so that not everyone in the coverage area has to receive the message unless it is needed. Alertable also allows police to, quote, triage the alert levels by color. For example, a green alert might invite people to the Kingston Police Fun Fair, whereas a red alert might indicate that a dangerous situation is unfolding. A mid-level orange or yellow alert might ask citizens to avoid the area of a traffic collision. Kingston Police Force encourages residents and visitors to use Alertable to stay aware and plan ahead by checking for closures, restrictions, and hazards in advance.
Thank you, Jesse. And now over to the LJI reporter for CJAI-FM Amherst Island Radio, Ted Evans, with a story about a petition in Loyalist Township that has generated a great deal of public support.
A petition with nearly 500 signatures helped Loyalist Township Council with their latest decision about the reconstruction of Main Street in Odessa. Ultimately, council voted on the option that aligns best with the petition to reinstate the existing cross-section. The report noted this option maintains the status quo for on-street parking, which was identified as an important factor by business owners and residents through project consultation. The report noted consideration will also be given to making adjustments to the existing layout around intersections in particular. Amy Dornekamp, owner of Mill Creek Vet Clinic on Main Street, spoke about the need for parking in the area, referencing surveys and public input.
While I support active living, Main Street is not the right location for a multi-use path. The 2021 Township Survey showed that while 75% supported an investment in active transportation, over 65% of those respondents commute more than 10 kilometers to work, making it impractical. A county survey completed in the last couple of months found that 81% of the respondents said a multi-use path would not benefit them more than parking. The community has spoken, and their priorities are clear. Parking remains a greater need than a multi-use path in this location.
David Savage, owner of Odessa Home Hardware, mentioned the petition and the customers he spoke with, noting the history of the store and importance of parking.
We garnered about 500 names, and all our customers that we spoke to thought it was not a wise decision. And, you know, we've been in the business, we've been in the village now since 1938 in the same location. To remove the parking on that side of the street or anywhere on Main Street would be devastating to any small current business or prospective business.
Dornekamp speaks about the existing shared parking and the potential of losing business.
There are only 5 spots on the opposite side of Main Street between Factory Street and Center Street. And those are already shared by the church, Home Hardware, my clinic, the bank, and the residents in that area. This is not enough parking. If clients struggle to park, they'll go elsewhere. And with 8 other vet clinics within a 15-minute drive, I'm deeply concerned we'll lose both current and prospective clients.
Engineering and Environment Manager Luke McDonald detailed the other options and why none of them were perfect.
There's no sort of slam dunk alternative to this. Each option has their trade-offs that are associated with it. The Force Main crossing, there's no existing crossing there now. So that would require work in water. That would require a number of permits from MNRF, CRCA, so on. So the cost would be considerably higher, as well as just establishing a new structural culvert crossing. The other option, while it may be less costly overall, there are significant concerns with the environmental condition of the property that the Babcock Mill rear yard is onto. Just some of the historic uses could lend itself potentially to contamination or things like that.
Councillor Paul Proderick addressed public concerns and noted the history of Odessa.
I appreciate Ms. Dornekamp's comment about the number of veterinary clinics being within a 15-minute drive. And we don't think of that, but it is. And again, it's the same for the hardware store. There's so many places within an easy access point. And I think when I go back, we've got an 1880s village that my grandparents came to on horse and buggy with 2025 traffic problems. And I don't think we can reconcile the multi-use pathways. I think we have to protect the businesses, protect the parking for that area.
Proderick also mentioned the concerns of cyclists in the area.
With the multi-use pathway, and I'm thinking of the cycling side of it, and I talked to a few who I would call hardcore cyclists who have told me things like they don't use that road. They go back Millhaven Road, back roads. And a couple of residents, and I was asking them about, you know, you have kids that age. He said, no, we don't want them on Highway been called Highway 2. And I also, on one visit, I stood just across from the veterinary clinic and the home hardware. And it was probably 35 cars that went by in less than 5 minutes. It's not the right location. I go back to the glory days of the Ernestown Eagles in the late 70s, and it's changed so much, Odessa. We can't cut off business growth. Odessa, I think, is in a bit of a renaissance, and the veterinary clinic, different things are coming back into the village. And, without the parking, it's a choke for them, I think.
Dornekamp noted the importance of Odessa's current needs.
This isn't about resisting progress. It's about being smart, practical, and responsive to the needs of our township to keep Main Street functional, accessible, and true to the spirit of Odessa.
Township staff will now begin to explore alternative connectivity routes surrounding the Babcock Mill, Factory Street, and Shane Street. The report notes that unless directed by council, staff would not consider these projects a priority. For Amherst Island Radio and the Local Journalism Initiative, I'm Ted Evans.
Thank you to Ted Evans for that story. Over to the Local Journalism Initiative reporter for CJPE, Brenda Little, with a story about the boycott of American events by Canadian historical reenactors.
Gathered to enjoy their hobby and share their passion of history with the public, these groups of people reenact time periods of the past by dressing up in costumes of the era and living the lifestyle of the time period. Reenactors go all over the country, the U.S., and sometimes abroad to take part in historic reenacting events. For the first time, the group is boycotting events in the United States due to national turmoil, border crossing concerns, and loyalty to Canada. So this year, they are focusing on gatherings across the province and Quebec. At this event, the reenactors were representing soldiers from the American Revolution by wearing the appropriate costumes and demonstrating a period authentic canon. With a fierce wind blowing in the background at times, I spoke with several reenactors about their hobby and plans for future travel to events. But first up is Jonathan Bradshaw portraying a soldier who talks about reenacting.
Getting thousands of people on the field at the same time just doesn't happen anymore. So we bring the authentic weaponry, the authentic uniforms, and we try to recreate the spirit of the battle, at least, if not the actual size of the battle.
And where do you do this?
We've traveled all over the place. We have guys that have fought in Europe during the Napoleonic battles. We actually went as far as Puerto Rico one year to attack the oldest fortification in North America, which is, surprisingly enough, in Puerto Rico. And they were celebrating down there, so we went down there in our northern wool uniforms and fought in the tropics. It was a very hot day.
Not bad. And how long have you been doing this?
I've been doing this since 2008. And we do quite a few different timelines. So we have events that are scheduled in the States. We have events that are scheduled in Canada, in Quebec. We have no intention of going to events in the States right now. We have a full slate of events in Canada and Quebec.
Another soldier and his wife, Robert and Marty, talk about their experience.
Oh, my name is Robert.
And how long have you been doing this?
About 45 years.
45 years. Hmm. And ma'am, yourself?
My name is Marty. I've been doing this 12.
Hmm. And how did you become interested in this, sir?
I'm involved. I lived in Prescott, downriver from here, and there's a Parks Canada site there, Fort Wellington National Historic Site. I volunteered there as a child and it sort of came naturally after that.
And yourself, ma'am?
Saw an event in Prescott at Fort Wellington, and my son at the time was interested, so we decided to investigate.
And do you go around, go around with the actors and
From time to time. I've traveled as far east as Louisbourg and Cape Breton, down to Pennsylvania, New York, Vermont, places like that. Yeah.
Do you think you'll be doing any reenacting in the United States anytime soon?
Not in the next 3.5 years, no. At least.
There is often a wide variety of reenactors that accompany each other. Glenn Mache portrays a trapper, and he tells us more. So how did you get started with this, sir?
I was a scout leader down through Toronto, and we headed down to Fort. And I walked into the fort with my scout troop, and in the corner of the fort, there was a teepee, two buckskinners. And I said, that's my calling. Prior to that, I used to watch Davy Crockett and Daniel Boone in black and white. And I said, one day I shall do that. Now here I am.
And how many years later?
I've been doing this for 35 years, if not more.
And you still love it?
It's my passion. This is how I relax from society.
And how often do you do this?
As many as I can. But they're getting so few in between. We're losing some events due to complications or other issues. They fold, and it's getting harder to get to find more and more. The military ones are getting bigger, and us buckskinners are getting smaller. Mm. And age. But I won't quit.
So I would imagine you've taken this to the United States. Will you be doing that again?
Not with the issues today at the border crossing. It's not feasible to go across. Cost-wise and politic-wise, it's stay home and support our own country is more fun. And we're trying to create more of these. It is possible. Mm-hmm. It's just where. And that's the issue.
Yeah. They do it, I think, here. Do they do it here every year?
Every year for the last 31 years. I'm one of the original four founders of this event.
Wow.
I have the newspaper clipping, and the museum has a 25-year anniversary scrapbook. And I'm on the front page with my three colleagues doing the final presentation for the press 2 weeks before this event started.
Wow.
And it's been strong all this time.
Yeah.
And it's good for the museum, it's good for the neighborhood. You know, it draws in people.
Mm-hmm.
And people are impressed with this, because we're showing the lifestyle before modern days. And all of us, we volunteer for this, our own expense, and we enjoy it. It's what you call a primitive camping, per se.
And Sue is a pioneer woman reenacting with the group.
Oh, my name is Sue.
And how did you become interested in this?
Oh, as friends that have been involved for quite a long time. There are people that have been doing reenactments for over 30 years. So one time I went out with a friend to see what they were doing and what it was about. And in order to stay for a potluck, we had to be period correct dress. So there was somebody that was having some outfits. So I got myself some outfits because I wanted to be there. And that was how it started. So then we came to Ameliasburg as the first rendezvous. And our kit wasn't exactly what we have seen here, because we have quite a number of pans and shelves and tables and lanterns, and was a little bit more rudimentary. We got to know the friends and then got to know where other reenactments were, got involved with a little bit of history, and the rest is history.
It was an interesting afternoon, and although the reenactment folks are disappointed that they will not attend American events anytime soon, they love what they do and look forward to all the Canadian events this summer. For the local journalism initiative, frequencynews.ca, and CJPE County FM, I'm Brenda Little.
Thank you to Brenda Little for that story. Over to the local journalism initiative reporter for CFWN, Dan Jones, with a story about a large donation by Cameco to a food program in Northumberland County.
Hi, I'm Dan Jones with CFWN in Cobourg, Ontario. Students in Northumberland County are getting a boost to their nutrition programs as Cameco is donating $5,000 to the Northumberland Food for Thought. The funds will be used to help purchase food for either a meal program or light snacks at participating schools. Beth Kalisnik, Peterborough Child and Family Services Community Development Coordinator, says this program helps improve student learning outcomes.
For many years now, Cameco has donated to Northumberland County Schools to support their student nutrition programs. This is an amazing partnership, and we are so grateful for their support. Northumberland Food for Thought is a steering committee that helps to support student nutrition programs in Northumberland County, and I sit on the steering committee. So when we raise funds for schools, what we do is we try to help them with any infrastructure purchases that they might need to make in terms of perhaps they need a new refrigerator or an appliance or equipment. So we help them that way, but we also help them in terms of trying to boost their ability to purchase healthy food for their program. So for instance, there's an online store where the schools often shop to buy food for their programs. And what we would do with funding from Cameco is provide a discount at that online store. So this funding reaches all of the schools because basically all of them do some of their purchasing at the online store, and it helps to reduce the cost, which in the end benefits their programs and helps them purchase healthy food for the students. And it's just, it has an amazing reach in terms of supporting these programs. So yes, again, we are so grateful for the funding. And it has been going on for a number of years now. We're very, very fortunate.
Okay, Bess, let's just discuss what the student nutrition program is. And some people may not be aware of it, but what does it do and how far does it reach?
Sure. So in Northumberland County, there are four 40 education sites. So basically all of the schools that are publicly funded in Northumberland County have a student nutrition program. Some of them have one or maybe two programs. Some may have a breakfast and a snack program. And the school decides, you know, how to run that program and how it will best meet the needs of the school. So it's each school runs them a little bit differently. And that depends on how many volunteers they have or if they're using school staff. But there could be a program that's a sit-down program, as sort of a traditional children gather together maybe in a gymnasium and they actually have a sit-down breakfast program. Could also be a bin program where schools prepare bins that go out to the classrooms, and then students will help themselves to the food that's in the bin during class, before class, whenever it's convenient or whenever the teacher provides that opportunity. Or they're also grab-and-go programs. So these are programs that are often used at high school or large schools, where students will be passing by a central point like the foyer or outside of student services, and they'll set up a table and they'll provide food that students can just take as they're passing by in their busy days. So maybe there's a wrap available for them or a breakfast sandwich, or maybe it's yogurt and apple slices, just whatever the program can provide for that day. So there are a variety of different models that schools use, and it's really based on the school capacity and what they can offer.
So then what positive benefits have you seen come or derive from this program?
Oh, my goodness. The benefits are far-reaching, of course. When you're providing students with a healthy start to their day, then you're improving health and you're improving learning outcomes. It's also a wonderful opportunity for students to gather and just share a meal together or share a moment together. And it becomes intergenerational as well, those benefits, because often the volunteers, you know, they may have students at the school or they may have grandchildren at the school. So there's a lot of intergenerational connection that happens there. And it's, you know, it is helping to reduce hunger as well, and just improve overall health. So really far-reaching. Teachers often note that classroom performance is much better, of course, when a student isn't focused on a hungry tummy and they're, you know, sustained through their studies through nutrition.
No, that's wonderful. So how would I be able to donate? If the general public, you know, when they hear this interview, they say, well, maybe I want to get involved. How can I donate to that program?
Oh, absolutely. So at the local level, you can go to northumberlandfoodforthought.ca, and there is a donate now button there, or there's a contact us button, and you can reach out and just ask how you can help, or where there might be a need in your area. So it's donations are welcome, and that's a wonderful way to support these programs. We also, you know, through volunteers, schools are often looking for volunteers. So if you're interested in volunteering, please reach out to us or reach out to a local school and then just say, you know, I've heard about these programs. I would like to help support in whatever way I can. And then they can place you in an area or where they have a need. And, you know, and then it could meet your own needs as well. And it's a wonderful way to get back to the community and support schools and students.
And thank you to Dan Jones for that story. Next up is Jessie Bell with CFRC's Environment Canada weather forecast for the Kingston region.
Thursday, May 29th, 19 degrees is your daytime high with a 40% chance of showers, dropping down to 12 overnight. Friday, May 30th, daytime high of 18 degrees with that same 40% chance of precipitation, and it is going to cool off a little bit overnight, dropping down to 11. Saturday, May 31st, finally some sunny conditions forecasted, very low possibility of rain, hovering around the 25% mark, but it is going to be 16 and sunny otherwise. Moving into the start of June, Sunday, June 1st is calling for a daytime high of 16 degrees, but it'll be mostly cloudy, not a lot of sunshine in the forecast. That does change slightly on Monday, June 2nd, however, high of 18 degrees, and it's going to be a sunny, beautiful day here in the city of Kingston.
And that's a wrap for this week's edition of The Corridor, supported by the Local Journalism Initiative and the Community Radio Fund of Canada. Don't forget to visit cfrc.ca for the latest in local and regional news headlines, concert and events listings, and more. You can also follow CFRC on Facebook and Instagram at CFRC Music and on Twitter X at CFRC. You can support CFRC and its independent news programming by donating via cfrc.ca. We'll be back next week with more in local and regional news. Thank you for joining us. We'll